I'm Tom Hall. This is Midday. My guest today is the president of the Baltimore City Council, Brandon Scott. He was elected president by his colleagues on the city council in a unanimous vote last May, despite Mayor Jack Young's preference for the council's vice president, Sharon Green Middleton, to assume the position that she had held in an interim capacity during the week's former mayor, Catherine Pugh, pondered her political future. Last week, Mr. Scott weighed in on where he sees Baltimore's future when he unveiled a detailed list of legislative policy proposals that, if enacted, would result in significant changes in the way the city operates and even who elects city officials. Baltimore City Council President Brandon Scott joins me for the hour in Studio A when Midday starts right after the news. Good afternoon and welcome. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for hanging with us for the hour. My guest today is the president of the Baltimore City Council, Brandon Scott. In May, when Jack Young was elevated to mayor following the resignation of former Mayor Catherine Pugh, Mr. Scott was chosen by his colleagues on the City Council to become City Council President. Last Wednesday, he released an ambitious legislative and policy agenda for the next 14 months when new terms will begin for all elected officials in City Hall. That agenda includes some significant revisions to the city charter, including the creation of an Office of City Administrator and lowering the voting age in city elections to 16. The council president will host a series of 9 town hall meetings throughout this month at several locations across the city. The first one takes place tonight in Cherry Hill. We'll take your calls a little later in the show. For now, you are welcome to send us an email or a tweet, or you can ping us on the WYPR Facebook page where we are streaming our conversation. Our email is midday@wypr.org. Our Twitter handle, @midday_WYPR. Mr. President, it's good to see you, sir.
Good to be back. Glad to be here.
So you have a number of very interesting policy proposals. I think you've given folks a lot to chew on, a lot to think about. So I applaud you for some ideas that we've not heard in the past and some ideas that you have already asserted, you know, as a member of the council. The thing that is on everybody's mind is crime and taxes. They want both of those things to go down. We're at 206 homicides. It's a number, you know, that speaks volumes and also doesn't say anything, you know, in both at the same time. You grew up in Park Heights. You know this town. How do you explain the persistence of violence, particularly since the unrest in 2015?
Well, I think that, Tom, I think I've said to you before, when you think about Baltimore's violence, people sometimes get caught in trying to make it something very simple, right? At its core, yes, it's about conflict and that conflict being resolved, unfortunately, in our city with the use of guns, right? In most cases, most of our homicides are related to gun and related to conflict. However, I think that it's time that we acknowledge that, yes, there are people who are killing people unacceptable, and we have to hold them accountable. There are people who are just reacting in ways they shouldn't, but there's also an environment in decades of how the city has operated that have created an ecosystem in which this violence persists. And one of the ways that that has happened is because our government has been ineffective, unwilling to change, and has remained committed to systems that don't work for all Baltimoreans. In order to see a Baltimore, a dysfunctional government cannot reduce crime. Just can't happen. Also, a city that doesn't control its own police department can't reduce crime. It's just not going to happen if you want to do that in a sustainable way that helps build communities. We're going to make efforts and strides like we've been doing, but I think it's time that we look at the whole system itself and make changes to make sure that we're improving Baltimore.
10 years ago, you yourself were a victim of a crime. Got your phone stolen when you're out walking your dog. That's something a lot of us do in this city. It's different on the street now than it was 10 years ago, and it's different than it was even 4 years ago in 2015. What do you think is different? And if we can identify what's different, what do you think we need to be doing differently to approach this problem?
Well, it's different in many ways, right? the streets are different, right? The mentality of the people on the street is different. There's no doubt about that. And also with, we cannot downplay the role of the increased access to and the increased usage of opioids and pills by everybody. You know, I was talking to one of my friends from Park Heights recently who said that he actually, him himself, used to be in the drug game, has now reformed his life, is working, doing great, great things for him and his family. And he said to me, he's like, Brandon, I went up to Park Heights and Cold Spring just to go to Rite Aid. And he says, I couldn't tell on the corner who was selling drugs and who was using, because they all clearly seemed to be under the influence. But also I think that what we also have seen since the unrest, if we've seen a perfect storm of everything bad, right? We've seen the increased amount of drugs. We know that stuff that happened with the drugs coming into the city. We've seen the issues, the turnover in the police department, the turnover in City Hall, which some of has been great. Me getting all these new young colleagues that are pushing progressive things that will make Baltimore a lot better city for generations to come. But at the other level, at the mayor level, we've seen a lot of turnover and turmoil there. And we know that Baltimore is a city that has a very, very strong mayoral form of government. So if you're seeing turmoil, if you're seeing ineffectiveness in that role, that's going to spill out into the streets as well. The police department has seen the same thing. There has been this continuing issues up until now with the police, the state's attorney, the judges. All of these things tie in together. And it seems to be the city that's also awash in guns. That's why, if you remember, Tom, I came under a lot of criticism in 2017 when I was going head to head with then Mayor Pugh about their lack of having a crime plan, one, at all, and two, about having a comprehensive one. What we're seeing on the streets today is, again, the results of decades of a refusal of Baltimore to think about crime outside of policing. We have been requiring too much of our police. And like I said in 2017, we have to make sure that all the agencies are participating. It's a comprehensive approach. And that's fortunately what we are receiving now, the plans that we're receiving now. But that's 2 years too late.
And you do require a crime plan every 2 years from the police department. What is, you know, that involves, as you say, a group of agencies.
No, actually, this, the way that this legislation will work, once we also have to understand that the city council cannot legislate on the police department as it's a state agency. So what this legislation is going to require is that, so that we don't go through what we have been going through over the last few years, actually at the public safety oversight hearing with the police last night, Chairman Scheifler actually said normally the former chair would start off this hearing by saying, where's the plan? Because we haven't had one. We have one now, but we want to make sure that doesn't happen in the future. And we want to make sure that that plan is comprehensive and coming from the Mayor's Office of Criminal Justice, who can pull together the health department, because gun violence is a public health issue.
So Commissioner Harrison's plan.
Yeah, Commissioner Harrison's plan is one. And then there's a companion piece, the comprehensive piece that's coming from the Mayor's Office of Criminal Justice.
What's your assessment of his plan?
My assessment of his plan is that I think that it includes, very much so includes, a lot of things that myself and council colleagues have been asking for years, and it's something that is very needed, right? We know that we need to civilianize the police department, get cops out of desk jobs, put them back on the street. That's something that I, even the mayor, has been asking for years. We know that we have to reassess the way that they use their resources, right? Something that they haven't done. They're answering too many calls for service. Most cities wouldn't send officers to some of the calls that they send people to. That, again, is burden. If we want police officers to actually proactively policing, we cannot have them tied down from call to call consistently. Also, one of the most important pieces of the crime plan, something that I've been demanding for years and want to see action on as soon as possible, is a group violence reduction strategy. We know that most of the violence that's happening on the streets of Baltimore is small groups of people on other small groups of people, and they know who they are. We need to be targeting them, removing them from neighborhoods, so that the other city agencies, our health departments, our nonprofit sector, our school system, recreation and parks, can backfill that area with services. But we have to target those individuals. And also, something that I think goes missing a lot of times is that guns themselves. we actually have to go after and target the people who are trafficking and straw purchasing these guns into Baltimore. Most of the guns that
67% come from outside of
And outside of the state.
And when you talk about targeting the folks who are doing the violence, I couldn't agree with you more. But I've been covering mayoral elections now for a while. In the last three or four, all the folks running for mayor have said exactly the same thing. We know who they are. We just need to go out and get them. So since 2015, we've also known who they are.
But they haven't done it. That's the difference. They have to actually do it. They actually have to go out and build the cases that are necessary to break down these organizations, make sure that we're getting those people, putting our hands on those people, not going into East and West Baltimore and saying that everyone that lives in Sandtown, Winchester is going to get patted down. No, that's the wrong way to go about it. But you know who's out there robbing people. You know who's out there shooting children. You know who's doing that. Those are the people that we have to target, along with the people who are providing them with the weapons.
You mentioned in your plan safe streets and ceasefire as two, violence interrupters programs. I noticed you didn't mention ROCA in the actual text of your plan. Is that what should I read into that?
Oh, nothing. Actually, I'm a very avid supporter of ROCA. Actually, when ROCA was first introduced to Baltimore, I was the person that drove them around. I was the first person that took them into the neighborhood so they can see.
Because we're spending, $13 million on it? It's not an inexpensive program.
But we know that it's...
Are you happy with the results?
The results are growing, right? I think that I'm not a person who thinks that ROCA is going to come here in 2 years and they're going to have 100% success. No, we're talking about rebuilding young men to be stronger men. And it takes great work. I have the utmost confidence in the folks there. James Timpson, who worked there, is a near dear friend of mine. He and I worked together in the Mayor's Office of Criminal Justice in the past. He worked at Safe Streets. He knows the streets of Baltimore. He can connect with those young people. But ROCA is not enough. We need more.
You mentioned the need for local control of the Baltimore Police Department. What is it that right now the Baltimore Police Department is actually a state agency? This is a law that goes back to the 19th century, as I recall. What is it that you could do with the Baltimore Police Department if the council was in charge of it that you currently can't do? The mayor hires the police department, police chief, sets the budget for the police department. It's overseeing the consent decree. What is it that the state's doing that you want to do?
So the state passes legislation. Let's be clear. There's no other jurisdiction in the state, and there's no other large city police department in the country that is not controlled locally, right? So when you look at that and you look at the Baltimore Police Department and you think about how dysfunctional it has been, maybe there's a connection to that, right? Where we're the odd man out. But also think about some of the things that we have had to do in Annapolis. I remember this session going down before Judiciary in the Senate committee, and my friend Bobby Serkin said, Mr. Councilman, thank you for coming to Baltimore City Council Day at the Judiciary Committee. Because every year we have to go down there to do things that Baltimore County doesn't, right? For example,
like what?
In 2005, God rest his soul, then Councilman Ken Harris introduced the first resolution to the city council that asked for the police district to be redistricted. Not until 2019, thankful to efforts of myself and my dear friend, Senator McCray, that we finally passed that, right?
The state had to weigh in.
The state had to pass a law.
Do you find a hankering among the Baltimore City delegation in Annapolis to put this as a front burner issue?
Well, we see. Well,
I'm not hearing from them that it is.
It passed through the House, the entire House this year, and we'll be working with our Senate colleagues to alleviate any concerns that they have. They have some concerns about lawsuits, et cetera. And actually, Tom, I'm glad you brought up the consent decree itself, because when the federal government was here in 2015, I begged them to make the state a party to the consent decree because it's a state agency. They're saying you guys are going to have to enact policy, legislation to go along with the consent decree that we can't enact here at the local level. But also, people should be mindful that the state can take away the power of the mayor to appoint a police commissioner anytime they get ready. And I think that if you want to have a reform police department, you cannot get a reform local police department that doesn't have local control.
One more question about crime before we take a break. You suggest creating an advisory commission for public safety. This was recommended by the Oversight Committee, who's overseeing the consent decree. Would this commission be at all redundant with the Community Oversight Task Force that we have, as well as the Civilian Review Board that looks at police misconduct?
Yeah, two different things. Actually, one, the chair of the Community Oversight Task Force is the person who helped me write this legislation, Ray Kelly, who now works for the consent decree team. And just to give you some history, this legislation has already passed. It just hadn't been formulated yet because we actually agreed that we would not populate this committee until the Community Oversight Task Force was done its work, right? And that's why it's one of the recommendations. So just to give you the history, when you look at the other police department consent decrees, New Orleans, Oakland, etc., inside of it, they have a requirement for a community policing steering committee. We, at the time, were pushing this legislation in Annapolis initially, right, to have this board created. And another example, at the last day, my good friend Senator Hayes, we were all good to go. And the last day, he came to me and said, look, the former mayor, Mayor Pugh, killed the bill, right? Another reason why we need to have local control. But this board, what this board is going to do is work with the police commissioner, right? It's going to be a wide array of people from all the nine districts, a young person, someone that lives in public housing, someone from the reentry community, someone from the LGBTQ community. And what they're going to do is work around with the police department around the community interaction plan. And specifically, they're going to work with the district commanders about the community interaction plan for that district so that we can have more community involvement. This is not the Civilian Review Board does a totally different job. They do great work at the CRB. This is something totally different and has the support of Mr. Kelly and the folks from the Oversight Committee.
In your heart, Mr. President, are you confident that in 6 months, 8 months, 12 months, we will have fewer murders, fewer robberies, fewer carjackings, fewer assaults in our city for the people who live, work, and visit here?
I'm confident, yes. I'm confident if the police department and our city agencies, if the administration pushes the agencies to do what's in the plan and they do it as quickly as possible, then we can see that. And people can rest assured while they don't work for the council and the council can't force them to do anything in reference to the police department, we will continue to be use oversight, that bully pulpit, and bring attention to and demand and request and yell and scream that they be more effective and more efficient on reducing crime in Baltimore.
City Council President Brandon Scott is with me here in Studio A. We'll take some of your calls and tweets and emails when we come back after a quick break. Our phone number here at midday, 410-662-8780. Our email is midday@wypr.org. Our Twitter handle @MiddayWYPR. And we are streaming on the WYPR Facebook page. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
This is your public radio, 88.1 WYPR.
Welcome back. I'm Tom Hall. It's midday. By the way, coming up tomorrow, it's the Midday News Wrap with guest host Nathan Sterner. Is the internet a breeding ground for violent white supremacist violence? The author Dale Barron, who has written extensively about sites like 4chan and 8chan, will join Nathan along with WYPR reporter John Lee, who will take a look behind the latest headlines locally. Plus, theater critic J. Wynn Russick will review Little Shop of Horrors at the Artcentric Theater. That's coming up tomorrow on Midday. If you're just joining us today, my guest is Baltimore City Council President Brandon Scott. You're welcome to join our conversation at 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. Our Twitter handle, @MiddayWYPR. And we are streaming on the WYPR Facebook page. Mr. President, your ideas about restoring integrity to city government. You are the third city council president we've had in the last year. We've had three mayors in the last 10 years. One of the suggestions you make is one that we've heard before, and it's about reducing the size of the Board of Estimates from 5 people to 3 people. How does reducing the size help with the integrity of government?
Well, I think that when you look at the recent history involving the BOE and look at a recent history involving our government, And also, I want to start by saying that also, Tom, remember, in this plan, we're also talking about looking at the charter itself in its entirety, something that has to be done
on a regular basis.
So that we're evolving as society and our city evolves, something that we have refused to do. But also, when you think about the BOE, and this is something that I've changed my opinion on, right? This is how even I have grown in my leadership, but also my understanding of what we need to do to properly represent the citizens of Baltimore. Well, you shouldn't have people who are not elected making the kind of decisions that, and listen, I love our city solicitor. I work very well with the Department of Public Works director, but they're not elected. And they are making.
And they currently serve on the
board.
And they are appointed by the mayor.
And they are, and we're talking about balance, but also when you talk about representation and people elect city council people who they think decide contracts and who they think vote on water bills, and they don't know that I'm the only one that has a say in that and that we're outvoted. But when you look at Baltimore's government, this is about taking a look at us versus the rest of the world, right? Rest of the cities, the rest of the counties that surround us, and understanding that if we want to be better, we have to evolve. Most cities have gone away from having these BOE factions. And if you look to the state, it's just three people on the board so that you can have a more representative government. And also that the people who are making decisions about how $500 million of taxpayer dollars a year are spent should be the people who are elected by those people and not appointed persons. This is about accountability. This is about transparency, making sure that our government becomes more reflective of that.
Although one of the other suggestions you have is the appointment of a city administrator who would not be elected. Who would choose the city administrator? What would the city administrator do? And how would that, what would that free up the mayor to do? Because the idea, I guess, would be to take sort of the day-to-day running of the city away from the mayor to another unelected official.
Yeah, let me start by saying this. I'm going to be clear. This legislation that I've already introduced to create a city administrator would not take away power from the mayor. It's impossible for a person who will be appointed, a mayor or appointee, to take away power from the mayor. What this would do, however, is bring Baltimore first in line with all of our surrounding counties, right? Baltimore County. County Executive Olszewski actually plucked the Baltimore City Social Services Director out to Baltimore County and appointed her to be his county administrator. Most cities across the country, including our neighbors to the south in Washington, D.C., Mayor Bowser has a great team, right? I had the pleasure of working with her team on this National Housing Task Force for the National League of Cities. She has a great team, deputy mayor, chief of staff, all of those things. Those individuals focus on the executive stuff for the city of District of Columbia. They focus on how to reduce crime, how to improve streets, how to improve their schools, how to better their recreation with the parks department. While she also appoints a city administrator who's a professional, someone who's degreed, who has spent time running agencies, running government, helping them to improve, who runs the day-to-day operations of the city. We can no longer in Baltimore afford to have our mayor simultaneously concerned about how we're going to do those top level things and worried about how high someone's grass is at the same time. We need to allow that person to have a professional doing that, that they appoint, that is held accountable to them, and that the council can hold accountable through budget and through oversight. But we should join most cities and all the surrounding counties in Maryland to have a city administrator.
Is Mayor Young's time allocated, you know, in an inefficient way? Was Catherine Pugh's time allocated inefficiently? You worked for Stephanie Rawlings Blake when she was the city council president and then became mayor. I mean, do you find that the time of the mayor is being distracted because of, you know, the nuts and bolts of running the government?
Well, absolutely, in my opinion. And this is nothing, listen, this is nothing against, this has nothing to do with Mayor Young or Mayor Pugh or any of the mayors that I've had in my lifetime. This has everything to do with me being someone who consistently learns, who consistently studies, who consistently looks at how we can improve. And when we often hear from business people, from citizens, from visitors to Baltimore about how Baltimore, well, the other cities are doing this, the other cities do that, the other cities do this, then we come back home or we stay here and we refuse to change and evolve.
So this is best practices.
This is best practice. This is the best practice. If you list out the top 40 cities and by population, you're going to find very few that don't have an administrator in some sense. Now, what we are not doing, what this legislation does not do, is change our form of government into being a city manager form of government like some cities have. There are cities that have administrators that fall under the mayor, like we want us to do, like happens in our surrounding counties and happens in the District of Columbia and other cities. And the thing is that we've actually had agency people leave Baltimore government and go be administrators and managers in other places, but we have not evolved to the point where we want to bring that here. This is about, again, making our government as efficient and effective as possible so that we have people who are professional, professionalizing city government, making sure that it runs the right way.
Brandon Scott is the president of the Baltimore City Council. He's here with me in Studio A. We are streaming our conversation on the WYPR Facebook page. You can drop us a tweet at @MiddayWYPR. You can send us an email, midday@WYPR.org. You can give us a buzz, 410-662-8780. Let's go to Sandra in Baltimore on the phone. Sandra, welcome to Midday with Council President Scott.
Good afternoon, Mr. Scott.
Good afternoon, ma'am.
Okay, so I was concerned when the state decided to place 5 casinos in the state of Maryland, which is one of the smallest states in the country. But they promised us that money would go to the schools to improve the schools. And I don't feel like that's been adequate, so I'm kind of wondering, so I have a two-part question. What's happening with that money, and why aren't the schools improved because of it? And also, can some of the funds be used to bring counselors to the schools? Because I think our children, especially like the elementary and middle school age kids, are being traumatized by what's happening in their environment, and I think having some counseling might assist some of these kids in helping them to finish school and go to college.
All right, thanks for the call, Sandra.
Thank you.
This is something that's mentioned in the Kerwin Commission report, and then, of course.
Yeah, thank you. And actually, Sandra, I'm glad you brought that up. So I'll start with your last question first. Trauma and trauma-informed care and practices is something that I support wholeheartedly. Actually, in our plan and in my speech last week, we asked you to visit our website, BaltimoreCityCouncil.com, and you can actually see the plan. We talk about that. And Councilman Zeke Cohen actually has a bill pending right now.
He was on the show just a few days ago, and we talked about it.
Yep, and we're going to be discussing how we're going to bring trauma-informed practices to our city agencies. So stand by, and there'll be much more conversation about that. To your first question, the answer is quite complicated, but the simple answer is yes. They are giving money for schools, so we're using that money as a part of our 21st Century Schools program where we're building and renovating new schools across Baltimore. Actually, I drove past Lake Clifton on my way here today, which is going to be reopening as a brand new school. However, it's still not enough. There is, and the number one education and youth-related thing in my plan is being supporting the Kerwin Commission. We know that Baltimore City schools are underfunded to the tune of almost $300 million a year by the state. This is what the state has told us. And we know that the Kerwin Commission itself, which is the most important policy decision being made in Annapolis today, and when the session comes back in January, will determine how funding and policies and practices are for our schools are determined over the next decade. And what we have to do is ensure that, one, equity is a part of that so that young people who are living in areas of poverty, living in areas like Baltimore City, get their due, but also that Baltimore City schools gets the amount of funding that is supposed to receive. So I would ask you to reach out to our state legislators and myself so that we can tie you into how you can help us and get on the bus and go to Annapolis to fight for full funding of our public schools.
We have a couple of questions about ethics in government. Here's one from an email from a lifelong Democrat. That's how this person has signed this email. How can the president, as part of the Board of Estimate, approve thousands of dollars in money to be paid to a mayoral aide who went to the South by Southwest conference for 2 weeks over and over as well? Inclusionary housing fund never seems to have enough money. One-party rule results in incompetence and corruption. How would the council president address those situations?
Actually, I think I've seen this gentleman on the internet from time to time. So two things. One, when you talk about the what was the last part of the question again, Tom?
Well, about one-party rule.
No, before that.
Well, yeah, the inclusionary housing fund.
Glad he brought that up, actually. So we actually passed legislation last year led by John Bullock that's actually going to increase the amount of money in that fund to the tune of $20 million. So it's something that we're addressing, and we know that we have to go even further. As far as the Board of Estimates, I think that it's clear that I want to do things differently with the Board of Estimates. However, when you talk about an incident like that, it would be very hard for me. Something that I'm mad that myself and my staff, we didn't catch that. But also, when this travel was approved by the previous regime, it would be very hard for us to say no, that this person can't get that money when they're the people who were in charge of them at the time. But what you can rest assured for me, actually, just yesterday, I voted no for the police department to spend hundreds of thousands of dollars to bring in people from the outside of Baltimore to give testing for the sergeant's exam. I feel as though we can find ways to do that locally. We can partner if they're worried about testing, meaning
putatively would be less expensive.
Yeah, we can figure out ways to use Baltimore County, Howard County, some of our neighboring police departments, and using them instead of always going to consultants who are going to charge us top dollar.
You've talked about separating the Board of Ethics from the Department of Legislative Reference. So the Department of Legislative Reference are the ones that research bills, help draft the language for the bills. Where would you move the Board of Ethics, which right now I guess works on a sort of voluntary basis?
Yeah, that's what we're going to be discussing. There's a piece of legislation that Councilman Dorsey has that has been introduced. Other people have other ideas. What we're going to figure out is how we can make the Board of Ethics actually work and where we can place it in city government that will allow it to do what it's supposed to do. And that's what we're going to be discussing, because we know that we have to continue to root out corruption. We've been able to do some of that with the Inspector General, the work that we did last year to make that office more independent, but we have to do the same thing with ethics.
Are you satisfied with the job that Isabel Mercedes Cumming is doing as the ethics investigator right now, the office of?
Yeah, no, I think she's doing a great job.
We have an email from Alexandria, typical of emails and calls we often get here. It's about squeegee kids. She says she's been sexually harassed and had her car damaged by squeegee kids. And then she says, when reported, an officer told me they are under a directive not to engage these individuals. And then this brings up the larger issue of youth works and the kinds of things that we can do for our kids, particularly in the summer. Squeegee kids, what's your take on them?
Well, first, I'll just say I'm sorry that she had that experience. That's something that no one should go to. And second, I will say that the police officer told her a flat-out lie, and that when people have these incidences, what they have to do immediately, if an officer tells them that, they shouldn't take that as the truth. That is something, if someone, a police officer tells you, oh, we can't deal with someone who just committed a crime.
So as far as you know, the directive of the police with the squeegee kids is to do what? To disperse them?
No, it's no. With her incident was a sex. She said she was sexually harassed and her vehicle was an assault, essentially. Her vehicle was damaged. That is an actual crime, right? You can't. Those are things you cannot do. So if that officer did not act, that's actually not fulfilling his duties. And what anyone that's under the sound of my voice, if not even with squeegee kids, if they feel as though a police officer in Baltimore did not do their duty, then they need to immediately call 911 back, ask for a supervisor. They should file a complaint, and then they also can reach out to my office at 396-4804 to let us know.
Because it important for? Do you think it's a good idea, good policy, for police officers to disperse groups of squeegee kids? The kids are on Martin Luther King Boulevard. The kids are on President Street, etc.
What I think that has to happen here, Tom, is that we have to have a complete conversation about the complete ecosystem. We cannot have anyone, in my experience with the incidents that actually happened, is we call them squeegee kids, but a lot of the ones with the violence incident has been actual adults. We can't have anyone, kid or otherwise, out there damaging people, hitting people, assaulting people. However, we also cannot, and I will not allow anyone to refuse the fact that a lot of these young men and women are out there because they're helping to feed their family. So that's the only way they're going to eat. So we have to figure out a way how they can make money, how they can get the education, how we can provide them with the jobs and things necessary in order for them to be successful, and at the same time, how people who are traveling and visiting in the city can be safe as well. And that's a tough conversation, but everyone has to, again, like I said last week, be willing to be uncomfortable and be in places that they're not normally, spaces in their mind and also in their hearts where they're not normally comfortable being, and if we're going to solve this issue.
In your legislative and policy agenda document, you do talk about youth works in particular, and yet there's a long section about what we can do for the young people in our city. Governor Hogan has refused to release, by my estimates, about $1 million, I guess, from what I've heard, that was to have gone to the Baltimore City Youth Works program. How's that deficit going to be addressed? What's the impact of that decision in Annapolis? And moving forward, is Youth Works a kind of program that can expand so that these kids can be employed?
Yeah, well, the number one thing is to your last point is that's actually what we call for in the plan. I'm going to, as council president, use my office, the power of my office, the power of the council to work with the Office of Employment Development, Finance, all of our other agencies to figure out a way that every young person that applies for YouthWorks actually gets a job. And that's going to include working with our private sector businesses to have places for them to go as well. Because we cannot rely on the governor or anyone else to do for us what we should be doing for ourselves. It's unfortunate that the governor did not release those funds. It's also unfortunate that he did not release the funds for the technology improvements to BPD, which are consent decree mandated for a state agency. It's also unfortunate that he didn't do that. But we have to, as the city, when we're not getting the assistance that we need, figure out ways to do it ourselves.
Did this year's YouthWorks program get, you know, dramatically attenuated because of the lack of funds?
Well, that we were short, and they knew it was short. And it's not always about, Tom, I think people have to be clear, it's not just about the funds. It's about having the slots for the children to get in. And what we have to do is systematically look at the program in its entirety and figure out how we, one, of course, can have the funding, but two, more importantly, have places for the young people to go and have those places be them to go where they're actually not just working, but learning and growing as a person and not just sitting in a seat all summer.
I'm Tom Hall. You're listening to Midday. We'll have more with Baltimore City Council President Brandon Scott after a quick break at 410-662-8780. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can send us an email, midday@wypr.org. You can tweet us at Midday WYPR. You can follow me on Twitter at Tom Hall WYPR, and you can catch us on the WYPR Facebook page. We are streaming there. You are welcome to ping us. Stick around. Welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. If you've just joined us, my guest is Brandon Scott, the president of the Baltimore City Council. He is the third person to hold that office this year. Puerto Rico gets three governors in a week. We have three city council presidents in a year. He was first elected to the city council in 2011 at the age of 28. He represented the second district after having served as an aide to Stephanie Rawlings Blake when she served as the city council president. Council President Scott will hold a series of town hall meetings to get reactions to and input about his legislative and policy proposals for the remainder of this term. The first town hall will be held tonight at Cherry Hill Elementary School. That event starts at 6:30. Now, even if you're not able to attend any of the town hall meetings, the council president invites you to share your thoughts about what you think the priorities of the council should be. You can send an email to councilpolicy@baltimorecity.gov, or you can use the hashtag BaltimoreCanBeMore on social media, and we will post links to both of those things on our webpage at wypr.org/midday. Council President Scott joins me here in Studio A until the top of the hour. You are welcome to pose a question to the Council President. We'll try to get to as many as we can. 410-662-8780, midday@wypr.org for sending us an email, @MiddayWYPR to send us a tweet, and you can catch us on the WYPR Facebook page. Let's go to the phones. Mr. President, if you don't mind, this is Dave in Northwood. Dave, welcome to Midday.
Hi, thank you very much for this interview, and your thanks a lot to Brandon's diligence in trying to make the city a better city.
Thank you, Dave.
Two questions, and maybe they don't apply to the city council president, but the Fraternal Order of Police seems to sometimes work against making some progress in the police department. I don't know whether this is the case, but I'd be interested to hear your comments and what can be done in this area. And also lawsuits against the city because of criminal acts by the department, and how can that be reduced? Thank you very much.
Thank you, and thank you, Dave. Thank you. I actually drove through Northwood yesterday morning. Two things. One, there's always seemed to be this back and forth between BPD and FOP. I know that Commissioner Harrison and President Mancuso haven't been seen eye to eye recently. I offered up again last week for them publicly through the Baltimore Sun to say that I'm willing to be the mediator. I'm willing to host them in my office and even host them at Coco's Pub to get them the best crab cake in the city in order for us to sit down and just have a man-to-man conversation about how we can try to move forward, right? Because what I don't want to see happen with this commissioner and this FOP president is what has happened in the past, and that's consistent bickering, that's undermining. Those are the things that I've seen happen in some other regimes. But I've been a person who's always been able to have conversations on both sides, and I think that's important. Even when I don't agree with the FOP president, I think when you're talking to someone respectfully as a man, as a human being, even when you disagree, they will always respect that. And we've been able to have that kind of relationship. I've had those same kind of relationship with police commissioners because Lord knows, I haven't always agreed with the things that they do. So what I want to do is try to pull them together and see past the past, but also figure out what we can do to move the department forward. And to your second point, we're actually co-sponsored legislation with Councilwoman Snead to outlaw the use of gag orders in police settlements. If people in Baltimore
and the city solicitor, sir, forgive me for interrupting, but he says that that's already in place, that the gag orders no longer apply.
Well,
there's confusion about that.
No, there's not confusion, because they not giving gag orders because they choose to doesn't mean that they won't when they want to again, right? One of the things about being a policymaker that I always tell young elected officials across the country is that you have to pass policy that will last longer than you, because yes, he might not want to do it as city solicitor, but if it's not in law that they can't do it, the next one might. So we have to make this. You can't be a city that's under consent decree that you asked for and you're trying to reform your own police department because of the actions of the police department itself, and then say to people who win lawsuits because they were victimized that you can't talk about that. That's talking out of both sides of your mouth. So we're going to pass that legislation and ban gag orders as well.
A couple of comments about your proposal to allow 16-year-olds to vote in municipal elections. It would be only elections held in the city of Baltimore. They're not going to vote for president or Congress or that kind of thing. We have Mary Lynn, who says it's a great idea. We have Carlton, who says it's a rotten idea. What's behind what animates the desire to let younger people participate in the electoral process?
Well, there's no greater resource no treasure in Baltimore than our young people. And Tom, as you know, as you spend a lot of time here hearing people call in, email, and tweet your show, young people are all the conversation, right? They're all the conversation about everything that's wrong with Baltimore, but we never include them in the conversation. We never amplify their voices into the conversation. And I think that when we want them, right, when we know that we're going to be impacting them by policy, then we should allow them the decision-making authority to figure out who represents them, especially at the local level. And I always point out that some folks who are saying that this is such a bad idea, that they said the same thing when they lowered the voting age to 18, that it was going to ruin the elections. But also, young people can do the most dangerous, 16-year-olds in Maryland and Baltimore can do the most dangerous thing that anyone can do in this country, and that's drive a car. They can do that. They should be able to vote as well. And remember that 17-year-olds in the state of Maryland are actually considered as adults. So no matter what, they're an adult, but they can't vote in elections. So we have to bring young people to the table.
Lewis emails that you have opposed a proposal to create mandatory sentencing for gun possession that both Mr. Young and Mayor Pugh backed. And it's one of the 26 points in your policy agenda is resisting future efforts to do mandatory sentencing. Governor Hogan certainly is on the other side of you on this issue. What's the reason for not imposing mandatory sentences?
Well, two reasons. One, the mandatory minimum bill that was introduced by former Mayor Pugh was a distraction tactic. It came right after we said that she didn't have a crime plan, and I ended a meeting and said, come back when you're serious about a plan. But also, mandatory minimums don't work, right? So if you talk to Attorney General Frost or any lawyer that's worth a nickel, they'll tell you they don't work. We have 30, almost 40 years of data to show that they don't work. Not to mention that the state of Maryland, when this bill was introduced, already had a mandatory minimum. So we know what ends up happening with mandatory minimums. They're not going to capture the people that they want to capture. And immediately on the street, and this is why you need elected officials who are connected to the community, people were laughing at that. You're not going to get you're not going to find people who are the people, the violent repeat offenders that we're looking to capture are not going to get caught in that. We have to be smart on crime and not tough on crime. We can target those individuals. The laws already exist in Maryland. We have mandatory minimums. We just have to figure out how we can make our police department more efficient and effective and making sure that they're making cases that stick.
It has been widely assumed that at one point you aspire to become the mayor of Baltimore. I know you're not going to announce any intention to run for that office right now, but tell me, in your estimation, now that you've been on the job of city council president for a few months, what do you think the difference is between the capacity of the mayor and the capacity of the city council president to affect change and make things and move the needle forward?
Well, being a mayor means that all the agencies are at your beck and call, right? So the mayor can wake up and say, do this right now, and they have to go and do that. As council president, you have to go through the practice of policy and passing legislation and getting that bill signed and getting the administration to implement that. And it's a great office, right? I think it's a great responsibility. I'm thankful to my colleagues for their unanimous support, and that's why when I walk around the city of Baltimore, no matter where I am, people are saying, like, why would you come out with this policy document now? Why won't you just stay in and hold the line? People aren't asking me for that. They're asking me to be the Brandon Scott that they knew as a council person and amplify that. They're asking me to go out there and shake things up and change things because Baltimore doesn't have 14 months of holding the line. We have to be drastic. We have to push, and we have to transform our city.
Are you thinking about running for mayor? And if you are, do you have a sense of a timeline of when you might decide whether to run for city council president again or for mayor or for anything else?
Well, the time for me to decide that will come, and everyone will know when I've made that decision. But I think that the most important thing is that for me to understand, one, we all know this is something that I've considered since I was a child, basically. But it will never be Brandon over Baltimore. I will make the best decision for the citizens of Baltimore about what my future is going to be, even if that can ultimately mean not running for office. That's what I'm in this. I'm in this to change my city, to make my city a better place. I'm not in this for personal gain. So that decision will come. But right now, we're focused on getting this plan in, transforming Baltimore, making our council more efficient, making it more accountable, making it more transparent so that we can have a better city.
Let's try to get one more phone call in from Robert in West Baltimore. Welcome to Midday, sir. Thank you for your call. We just got about a minute or two left. We're doing great. What's on your mind, sir?
Just a couple of things. Why wouldn't he commit to term limits? Because you've had most of the people who've presided over the city that one way or another they participate in its collapse with the excuse of blaming it on mayor. And will he commit to term limits? And I'll take my second question off the air. The other thing is, if you really are the president, you want to create policies and legislation as opposed to creating a one-man bandstand show. The president only accepts the legislation from the other city council people. And then last question, do you think it's time that the city politicians have had a long enough chance to wreck, ruin, steal, and destroy? And why not step aside and let an outsider run for mayor?
All right, thanks for that call. We just have about less than a minute left.
So two things. One, I voted for term limits in this term. So Councilman Scheifele introduced that bill early in the term. I was actually one of only two people to vote for it in committee, and I support term limits. And secondly, most importantly, what I think is that All elected officials are not created the same. I'm not the people before me. I've came in and tried to change city government since the day that I've gotten there. I am someone who grew up in the forgotten Baltimore, someone who grew up and knows what's wrong with our agents, what's wrong with our city, how to move it forward. And we won't accept a person who's not a lawyer can't walk into a law firm and be a partner. We should treat government the same. We have the people who need someone as mayor who understands it and understands how it needs to be transformed, but also understands Baltimore, especially the places in Baltimore where people forget.
Baltimore City Council President Brandon Scott, the first of 9 town hall meetings with the council president is tonight at 6:30 at the Cherry Hill Elementary School. We've got a full list of all the meetings that have been scheduled throughout this month and early next month on our website, wypr.org/midday. Mr. Council President, thank you, sir. I appreciate it, and good luck. That's it for us today. Coming up tomorrow, guest host Nathan Sterner unpacks local news with WIPR's John Lee, and author Dale Barron explains the role that the internet plays in advancing extremism. Plus, J. Wynn Russick reviews Little Shop of Horrors at Baltimore's Artcentric Theater. Lunch for our guests today was provided by Eddie's of Roland Park. They're celebrating 75 years as Baltimore's gourmet grocer. Eddie's is making surprise workplace lunch drops every week this year as part of their year-long 75th anniversary celebration. For details, visit eddiesofrolandpark.com/anniversary. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.